Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra concludes its season tomorrow evening with a showcase for the orchestra. Three works on the program, which according to my guest today, could each be a concert closing work. Daniel Heggie is the principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony and my guest today, who will lead the orchestra in Franz Joseph Haydn's Symphony No. 90, Zoltán Kodály's Harjanos Suite, and Igor Stravinsky's The Firebird, Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. Heggie is the music director of the Wichita Symphony Orchestra in Kansas. In addition to his Tulsa guest conducting post, he's also the principal guest conductor for the Binghamton Philharmonic in upstate New York. He joins us today to talk about the program and the interesting facts behind some of the works that will be performed Saturday night. Daniel Heggie, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Rich.
Yeah, you have a very interesting program.
Yes.
Kodály is not often that performed, but this is probably the most performed work by him, the Harjanos Suite, from a big opera that never gets performed.
Right, right.
And then the Haydn Symphony 90 and the Stravinsky The Firebird. What's your thoughts on this program?
Well, this is a great season closer concert because we have three concert ending pieces. Any one of these three pieces could end a concert and it would be euphoric. It would just be really fantastic. And one wouldn't necessarily assume that from especially Haydn, because it's classical-sized orchestra, so it's a little bit pared down. You don't have the monstrous-sized orchestra that you have, like, you know, with Stravinsky or even the Harjanos, which has a huge battery percussion. It has three trumpets and three extra cornets that are playing, so you've got kind of a wall of trumpet sound and big brass and all that. So how could they all three be closers? It's just really how they end and how they build up to it and the quality of each of the pieces. So it's a perfect program to showcase the orchestra, the Tulsa Symphony. There's no soloist on the program. It's just all orchestral showpieces. And the other really interesting thing is that they're all different from each other. They show a lot of variety. For example, the Haydn is right out of the 18th century. You got the Harjanos and the Stravinsky, which are kind of early 20th century masterpieces. The first piece, Haydn, is absolute music, so it's not based on anything else. It's just strictly music in the abstract sense. And then you have the Harjanos, which is from an opera, as you mentioned, and of course Stravinsky, which is ballet. And those do tell stories, as it were. So you've got opera, ballet, and absolute music. It's just a great combination, and there's so much variety in color and style.
Now, let's talk about the Symphony No. 90. When most people think of Haydn's symphonies, you think of it as sort of the middle part of a program. Why could it be a closer, although I'm sure it's going to be the opener for the,
yes,
the concert?
Yeah, in this case, it sort of functions like an overture piece in a sense. And it starts with kind of a ba-bum, you know, kind of like here's a curtain raiser kind of piece, you know. And it has this beautiful, very short adagio at the beginning, which is kind of a trademark of many of the Haydn symphonies. And then it has a standard four movements. And why would it be a good closer? Well, the last movement, a lot of Haydn symphonies actually are really good closers. He just has such an affinity for writing dramatic music, even though I said before it's absolute, it's not based on a narrative or anything, but the music itself is very, very dramatic. And so the last movement of it is kind of a, almost like a perpetual motion kind of figure that's going on in the strings and a lot in the woodwinds as well. It's interesting because in the last movement, he creates kind of a joke. I mean, Haydn is really a master of surprises in general. It's not just in this piece, but in almost any of the symphonies, he creates surprise for the listener.
Surprise symphony, for
example. Yeah, the surprise symphony.
The farewell symphony.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's lots of gimmicks. I mean, there was show business.
Business, and yet it works musically, too. It's interesting to analysts who look at the music because one of the surprises could be a shocking harmony that he goes to, juxtaposed harmonies that don't seem to fit together, and yet they do, because he's already starting to bend the rules. He's already starting to lay some of the foundation for Beethoven to build on. But the other thing he uses are silences in the music, and that happens in many of his works, and it really happens very obviously in the fourth movement of this Symphony No. 90 that we're going to perform, where he writes in a very triumphant sounding ending, and yet it's just after he barely got into the recapitulation, and then all of a sudden after the silence it moves on into a different key and kind of goes on like, well, what's happening now? And it has a great dramatic effect and usually leads the listener into going, is this it? Is this the end? And then you get to the actual end which also sounds very triumphant. And then it goes back to repeat again the development. And then it goes back to that, of course, you have that ending kind of built in again to the middle of that section. And so he really keeps the listeners guessing. And he seems to do it with such an incredible skill and wit. He's one of the really the greatest composers. And I think that, unfortunately, he's underrated by so many people. They say, oh, Haydn, you know, but what about Mozart? And what about Beethoven? I think, hey, well, let's not shortchange them at all. I mean, Mozart's up there on the highest pedestal and Beethoven. But I'm saying Haydn belongs up there, too. It's just a great symphony. We played through the first movement last night, and I stopped at the end and I said, this is just amazing music. That's just after the first movement. Second movement has this beautiful double variation form, which is just so creative. And then the third movement is a minuet. And then the fourth movement, as we talked about, kind of this very fast, exciting music.
And of course, has this joke embedded in this last movement. And we think of Mozart of having that duality of you can have this moment of sublime music and then, you know, ribald humor in mm-hmm. the next measure. Mm-hmm. Well, this is sort of what Haydn's doing with this symphony, too.
Yeah,
he's got the sense of humor. You know, Mozart, this was out there before Mozart.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Haydn, the way he's able to just understand human nature so well, and especially for being really in the Esterházy estate for so many years. I mean, practically his whole life composing. Of course, he composed some of his greatest symphonies even after that. Mm-hmm. But even though he was kind of sequestered away and didn't travel so much around Europe, his pieces did. And so he was actually quite famous and quite well known. But he seemed to have this understanding of people and knowing what they would be listening for and how to surprise them and how to help them be entertained by his music.
And you talk about that last movement, and in many ways, it would be like today a pop song in which, you know, you hear the refrain in the chorus, and you hear the refrain in the chorus, or, you know, and you expect, okay, that's the end. And all of a sudden, no, here's another refrain.
Right, but you know, it goes into a different area. Right.
Yeah, so, you know, it's like it would have confounded audiences of his age because he's breaking those sort of hard and fast rules.
Right, and it does confound audiences even today, so even though they may not be as familiar as the people back then during Haydn's time with the music.
Now, but have you ever had audience members clap in that big
course.
Silence?
Oh, yeah. Every time. Every time.
So don't clap during the silence.
Well, or clap. I mean, you know, follow your instinct, because that's what Haydn would have liked.
And it is a pretty good-sized pause. It's about, what, 4 bars?
Yeah, it's 4 bars. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's really like just a grand pause. I mean, he put 4, but, you know, to stand there and go 1, 2, 3, 4. I don't think that's what he meant. Yeah. I think when you're looking at the music, you're trying to really translate the idea overall to a certain kind of sound. And it wasn't really a traditional idea at that time in composing to just write like a fermata over a bar, to just wait randomly. So he put in 4 bars thinking, okay, they get the idea. They understand this is supposed to be a big break mm-hmm. in the music, and then goes on from there.
Of course, Mahler, a century later, would say, take a pause.
Yeah, right. They put GP or grand pause in there or something.
Or after the movement, say, yes. An interval.
Yeah, right. Take 5 minutes here before you move on. He does say that in the Resurrection Symphony after the first movement.
Yeah. Is this a piece you've conducted many times?
Oh, yeah. I've done a lot of the Haydn symphonies. I'm a huge, huge fan of Haydn's music. I feel at home somehow with his music. And I've done many. I've probably done 20 or 25 of his symphonies.
I still have 3/4 to go.
Yeah, I know. He put out a lot. And the thing is, you know, someone might say, oh, 90, that's such a gem within his. It's like, it's great, but is it greater than 89? Is it better than 91? Is it better than, I mean, you can't, at a certain point, I think when something's on such a high quality level, it almost doesn't make sense to try to rank them and say, well, this one's better than this one, because it's kind of like trying to rank composers too. You know, are you really saying, okay, Schubert is better than, it's like, no, you can't rank them really. It's just part of his output, and it's a great symphony.
Well, why don't we hear a bit of the second movement of this piece, the double variation mm-hmm. movement. This is a beautiful part of the symphony.
It is.
Well, here's music by Haydn, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony tomorrow evening in a program that will also include works by Stravinsky and Kodály. My guest, Daniel Hege, a principal guest conductor, will be leading the orchestra at the Performing Arts Center. Here's some music by Haydn. Thank you. That's music from the Symphony No. 90 by Franz Joseph Haydn, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony tomorrow evening, along with two other works by Zoltán Kodály and Igor Stravinsky. Daniel Hege is principal guest conductor of the orchestra and my guest today. And the next piece, again, it might not be that familiar to audiences, although it's played probably more, maybe the Dances of Galanta and then the Hariano Suite of Kodály. Mm-hmm. Kodály, for those who don't know, a major pedagogue in music, as well as a composer.
That's right.
So, as I mentioned, this opera that comes from very rarely gets performed. I think it's in Hungarian. Mm-hmm. It's four acts, and it's sort of a form in which a lot of people might be familiar with because it's sort of a Don Quixote in a way. It's a sort of a Don Quixote story, not like it, but it's an old man regaling people with the story of his exploits.
That's right. Yeah, he's a soldier, and he's basically spinning yarns. You know, it's like picture a guy in a bar, and all these people kind of gathered around to hear his storytelling, and he just tells of all these kind of exploits. And even Kodály says in the introduction to the score, he says, well, of course, these aren't true stories. He says, but actually, that's not the point at all. It's that this man is talking about kind of a poetry or the kind of wish that we all have, too, as people, to try to kind of reach for something really grand and fantastic in our lives. And that's what he does when he's regaling all these stories. So it becomes kind of this really fantastic storytelling. And everyone loves great storytelling. And he says at least Hariános has the courage to explore that with his imagination and then tell everybody about it. And, of course, it's very comical. And the music even reflects that, you know. I mean, when he says he single-handedly defeated Napoleon, single-handedly, and all his forces, and he had Napoleon begging on his knees, you know, for his life and everything. I mean, it's just very funny. And what does he do? He mocks the Marseillaise. You know, he has the theme, the French national anthem, and it's just mocked by the low breath. Boom, 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 boom. And, you know, the kind of like a little funeral dirge at the end of that movement. But it's also filled not only with comedy, but with a lot of pathos. You know, you have the middle movement lead or song, and that's where we have Hariános and his betrothed are very homesick because they've traveled to Vienna to explore that city, and because they've been called, because supposedly Hariános, he had an admirer in Napoleon's wife. She wanted him to come there. Of course, that's part of his storytelling, you know. And so we hear the Viennese clock in one of the movements, which is so colorful and rich with all the percussion and the woodwinds and brass. And it builds to this incredible finale at the end, you know, where we bring in the extra brass and everything. So it's very climactic. And of course, it starts with what we call an orchestral sneeze. And that's by Hungarian tradition. If someone says, the story I'm going to tell you, and then someone sneezes, it's supposed to confirm that it's true. So if someone sneezes, it's a sign that it's going to be true. And so he builds that. He actually has an orchestral sneeze in there. And it's
now,
interesting
how
we
work.
Well, you have this kind of, it starts off with these trills in the woodwinds and a pizzicato in the strings, and it kind of goes up this, ba-pow! Like that. So it's like, like that. It has a build up, and the orchestra actually does that. And then you kind of have this slow introduction, and it builds, and you have this sense that, oh, these are going to be some brilliant tales that we're going to hear this evening in this storytelling. And then you have the various movements. And I do want to say that also in that middle movement where I talked about the lead, which is German for song, where there's a homesickness, and in the later movement as well, we hear what sounds kind of like a hammered dulcimer, but it's a cimbalom.
Yeah.
And that's a featured folk instrument of Hungary. And that will add a lot of the distinctive color to the orchestral sound and these kind of improvisatory woodwind figures that go over.
Very important in Roma music. Yeah.
So
it's beautiful. It's an amazing instrument.
Yeah, it is. And the whole piece, really, just the way he uses kind of the style of folk music in it and makes it so, so colorful. It makes it just a very rich and captivating work. So it probably isn't done as often as people might imagine because it does take a large battery of percussion. It takes this cimbalom. It takes extra brass and so on. So it's a lot to put on it. A saxophone is in the fourth movement as well. But it goes along. The whole piece is only about 25 minutes. And you really feel like you're being told stories, but just by the orchestra. So
And it is one of those pieces that really the program, even if you don't know the program, you're going to get a sense of the program because of his orchestration and the way he's able to emphasize the story
exactly.
through music.
Yeah, it's true.
That's a real gift.
Yes, I know. Not every composer is really, really good at it. But there's something about it. His language is very direct. You have to remember that he and Bartok really were growing up alongside of each other and even studying at the same exact time from the same teacher. And they both looked at folk music and took dictation and understood that very well. But they really have different kinds of sounds.
They have very different philosophies in how they express that, too. Yeah, just completely different.
It's just really, it's a fascinating piece, and I'm just so happy we get to do it. And it does feel like a concert closer, also, to allude back to what I had mentioned at the beginning. And it will close the first half of the concert, so then we move into intermission.
My guest today is principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, Daniel Heggie, who will be leading the orchestra in their concluding concert of the year, featuring Stravinsky's The Firebird, Zoltán Kodály's Hari János Suite, and Haydn's Symphony No. 90, Saturday evening at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Well, Igor Stravinsky's The Firebird, this is a very familiar piece of music, and you're doing the 1945 version.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember right, Firebird was written in 1911?
Yeah, 1910.
1910?
Yeah, premiered in 11, yeah.
And then he did another revision in 1919?
19, yeah. So.
And then he comes back to it in 1945. What was his obsession with coming back to this work?
Well,
was it as a result of ballet productions or for other reasons?
Well, part of it was in 1910 when he wrote the Firebird Ballet, you know, we're talking about 45 minutes to an hour of music, and it's for a gargantuan orchestra. I mean, we're talking like 8 horns, you plus an assistant, that's 9 French horns. You've got a wall of trumpets and brass and a huge battery percussion. I mean, it's so huge. I mean, it fell into that time, you know, when Mahler was still writing symphonies and everything too. So this was during the age of kind of this gargantuan
bigger is
orchestra.
Better.
Yeah, bigger. It got bigger and bigger. End of the 19th century into the early 20th century, the orchestra kept expanding and expanding and probably culminating with Gurlieder by Schoenberg, where it's just so massive you can barely fit an orchestra on the stage. So it fell into that era. And then later, by 1919, already the tide was turning. And he also wanted to make something that would be very accessible to audiences, not just the orchestra playing in the pit for a ballet, but also for an Nice to Joy as a concert suite. So he took that music and made his 1919 suite, which he did then, and really pared the orchestra down to a much more conventional size, pairs of woodwinds, the 3 trumpets and 3 trombones, tuba, and so on, and a much smaller battery of percussion, so on. So that made it much more accessible for orchestras to use because it wasn't so costly. It's shorter. It was only 23 minutes and so on. So now we get to 1945, and what he does is he takes about 7 minutes more out of the ballet and inserts it into his 1919 suite. So we still have all of the music from the 1919 version in this 1945 version, but he simply takes more of the ballet music from his original 1910 and puts it into this 1945 version. I hope that's clear.
Yeah. So why do you think he went back to it? I mean, most composers, you know, you do it, move on to the next
well,
case.
Well, Stravinsky, you know, many composers would revise their works, but Stravinsky liked to do it and then get copyright, get publishing. I think it was another way to earn money.
Yeah.
Because if you can take existing work and change it somewhat, you can change it enough
and
that you get a new copyright.
Right.
And it also gave more options to orchestras too, because again, he didn't expand the orchestra so much from the 1919 version. It's not nearly as big as the ballet that one could play. And it's about 30 minutes instead of 23 or instead of 45. It's like right in the middle. So it's something. He might have thought that it was very interesting also for orchestra players and for audience to hear a little bit more of the ballet music.
Copyright, that's probably
but
it.
Well, a lot of my professors would tell me that because he did the same thing with Petrushka. I mean, the 1911 version is also for a very huge orchestra and it's very costly to put together. He thought, why don't I just keep the same music and do Petrushka 1947 version?
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be something that orchestras will be more likely to play.
See, this was an issue that Beethoven and Brahms didn't have to deal with because they didn't have the copyright issues in those
right,
days.
Right, exactly.
I mean, to the extent that you had in the 20th century.
So they would go back sometimes and revise their works, and then you'd have a later publishing date, but it wasn't like that was another piece.
Right.
This is really like another work when you say a 1945 from the standpoint of a publisher and getting copyright money from it.
Yeah.
So it's a practical thing sometimes for composers to do that. And he does change some things. So even though we retain some of the 1919 actually all of the 1919 music in the 1945 version. He changes that music very subtly here and there. So some of the passage work is different. It's not something that an audience member would pick up on necessarily, mm-hmm. but it's definitely something the players on stage know.
Yeah. Yeah. So that 7 minutes that we add from 1919, what did we miss in 1919 that we're going to hear in 1945? Is it a specific movement, or is it more elaboration of the things you're already hearing?
Yeah, it's kind of an elaboration. It's three pantomime movements. That's what he's titled it as, mm-hmm. pantomime. So this would be during some of the dances. And they're inserted right into the center of the piece. So in the 1919, you have the two first movements, which is the introduction, and then you have L'Oiseau de Feu, the variation of the bird. And then right after that, in the 1945 version, he inserts, I want to say four movements, but three of them are pantomime and one is an introduction to the next part. And then you get to the round of the princesses, which goes back to the 1919 version, and it stays basically the same after that. Mm. But there are minor differences here and there, just very small things that are a little bit different.
When you're doing this, the Firebird, a piece like this, it's in many ways sort of pre-shadowing what you're going to hear Stravinsky do in the next few years with mm-hmm. The Rite of Spring and then everything that comes later. Mm-hmm. But in many ways, it's right in that sort of late, very late Romantic tradition.
Absolutely. I mean, you can see he's picking up on Rimsky-Korsakov. You can hear him kind of ushering out the old 19th century idea of Russian music, but bringing in brand new ideas. I mean, it's really a milestone in many ways of Russian music when the Firebird came out in 1910. I mean, it was something completely new and different, and yet you could hear its connection back to the 19th century. And it's just amazing how far he progressed from Firebird going to Petrushka a year later and then to the Rite of Spring a year after that. But really, he kind of laid a new template for sound and what was possible from an orchestra. It almost sounds impressionistic in some ways, too. I mean, it sounds a little bit like Debussy, and we know that he already knew of some of Debussy's work by that time, by 1910.
And he was in Paris at that point, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And you also have to remember that this was also this time in Paris when Picasso and Braque, and all of a sudden the art movements are changing radically from year to year. I mean, it's Cubism now, mm-hmm. and then it changes almost within a couple of years. It's something else.
Yes.
I mean, do you think that played a role
in this
sort of huge
absolutely.
Difference in 4 years between, say, Firebird and the Rite?
Yeah, I do think that. And, of course, we have to remember this is on the eve of World War I, these years leading right up to World War I. So there's all this turbulence that's going on in Europe in general. And, of course, I think with these artistic movements shifting and changing so quickly away from just kind of a realism to something that's very, very different. I mean, I oftentimes think of Stravinsky's music as like Picasso in a way. You know, you see two eyes on the same side of the head. That's a little bit like Stravinsky's music sometimes. You know, you're hearing it, it's like, well, it's classical, but it has a classical sound to it, but it's like turned on its head slightly, you know. And it's like you're looking through a prism or something and getting a different perspective on it.
Now, the Kodai, that is a pure programmatic piece of music, and where the story is probably ingrained with how you're thinking about the music. In the ballet, it's a little different. Do you take a more of a dance perspective when you're conducting the Firebird, or you think of it as an absolute piece of music that just happened to be dance music?
I think that I'm always aware of it being a ballet and what's kind of going on at the moment. In fact, there are a few places that it's useful to explain, even to the players, what's going on at this point, because then they kind of get this idea, you know, like where the bird is being choked or something, and imagine feathers going out right mm-hmm. here or something like that. So I'm aware of the storyline and that there would be action going on. But the nice thing about being able to do it just as a concert piece is you can really focus on the music. When you're conducting it as a ballet, of course, you're always serving the dancers.
Tempo.
tempo. Right. Yeah. And if you don't... you have to take time in places that are prescribed mm-hmm. By the dancers or the choreographer, mm-hmm. Which is fine. I mean, that's what you're supposed to do. That's exactly the function in that particular case. But when you're doing it as a showpiece, just for the orchestra, you can really think about the music itself. And if there's an interesting chord progression or there's something that happens here, you can actually treat it as a musical issue and not as a choreographed issue. And so it's nice to be able to focus on those kinds of elements of the music.
When we hear a little bit of the Firebird, what's a special passage for you as far as just sort of a little passage that really means something special to you?
Well, you know, I always like the Infernal Dance, King Cacciai. That's always, so dramatic and usually wakes people up pretty well. It's one of the most climactic moments.
Doesn't it come right after the Berceuse?
That Berceuse comes right after that.
Oh, right after that, yeah. Okay. I'm thinking the next movement, which has
the finale.
The big boom.
Right.
After you've had this Berceuse.
Yeah. Yeah, that finale is really great, too. I mean, that's like a rising phoenix, when you have the horn playing the solo and there's just kind of this glistening sound in the strings. And it just builds and builds kind of inexorably to this grand, grand ending. You know, we talked about three concert closers on this program. There's really nothing I can think of that could top the Firebird ending. So that has to go last on the program. And it's a great capstone, really, for the entire season.
Well, why don't we leave listeners with that? And we hope a lot of people will come out. It's been a great season. I know next season has been released. Or what are you looking forward to next season?
Everything. I always look forward to coming and working with the Tulsa musicians and being in the Tulsa community. It's always exciting. So all the three concerts I'm coming for are really going to be something I'm looking forward to.
All right. Well, it's been a good season, and we look forward to the last concert of the year with Stravinsky, Kodály, and Haydn.
Yes.
Daniel, thanks very much for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you.
Daniel Hagee is the principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra and will lead the orchestra in their season finale Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center, playing the work we're hearing, Stravinsky's The Firebird, Zoltán Kodály's Harjanos Suite, and Haydn's Symphony No. 90. For information on the concert, visit tulsasymphony.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening. Thank you.